Back together again, you and I chatting it up Tuesday, July 7th style, right here on Connecticut Today. I wondered if the growing buzz regarding Democratic Socialist candidates around the U.S. would take root here in Connecticut. Financial expert, analyst, and regulator Gerson Gibbs explained those new Trump accounts that are now available. Are they worth it? Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio dropped by for her weekly spot, and we chatted with Quinnipiac University civil engineer Professor Ari Perez about a big midtown Manhattan building in New York City showing some dangerous instability.
So if you'll allow me here as we start off the week with the us back together, you and I together, Chris doing everything else, news behind the board and all that, right here on Connecticut Today, WICC 600 AM, 95.9 FM, and of course online at voiceofct.com. If you will allow me, it's Paul Pacelli. Hey, how are you? Had a great time filling out, Lord knows I know how to fill up, with the award-winning Fantastico Melissa in the Morning program on Thursday and yesterday on Monday. Here we are with a Tuesday, and I have to tell you, to quote a phrase from the late, great Rush Limbaugh, I told you so. I told you so. And I'm not doing this to, you know, toot my own horn or raise my own flag or anything. But I said that this was so apparent in your face, you could not in any way, shape or form possibly ignore it. Now, what's it? What are you talking about today, Paul? What are you all incensed about today, Paul? Well, I'll tell you. I've said for the past 2-3 years on this program that the Republican transformation over what the Republican Party used to be, which was considered exclusively the party of the rich, the party of the corporate person, the party of the CEO, the party of the young or middle-aged couple with the two kids who had the million-dollar home down the block from yours, which is only worth about 300 grand, and you don't have a real driveway or a backyard. So for years, the Republican Party did that, or that's what they were happy to be perceived as. Yeah, I guess they were happy with that perception. Well, Donald Trump came in late 2015. I thought it was a joke. Yes, 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 I did. I thought it was a joke, but he, in the course of now 10 years, and I don't think he's staying for the rest of this term, but that's just me, so let's say 12. In the course of 12 years, he has fully flipped the script on the establishment Republicans, which I said he did. I knew he would do once he got reelected, and what he's done. And the large base, a big chunk of the base, the former base, I should say, of the Democratic Party, is now with the Republicans. Young, white, male, disaffected voters. These are the voters that Senator Chris Murphy always talks about when he says, hey, we got to welcome those people back into the Democratic Party because our party, Senator Murphy saying our party, meaning that we've abandoned them. And I agree with Mr. Murphy on that. He's in the news for another not so agreeable thing. I'll get to that later. But you know what? Chris Murphy is right about that. As much as you and I like to pick on him, and you can kind of see Dick Blumenthal in the background shaking his head going, ugh. But Chris Murphy is right on that. So we were right on that. So give us all, it's a pat in the back. I'm patting myself on the back. Now, the other part of it that I was right and you were right on, many of you perceptive people like me, is the Democratic Party is about 10 years late, but they're getting started. And I read an interesting article this morning. I think it was in the Telegraph. I think I was half bleary-eyed in bed trying to figure out what this was. I think it was in the Telegraph. And they said, well, now, yeah, all the Democrats laughed 10 years ago at what Mr. Trump was doing that he has now effectively done. And some of his poll numbers are starting to creep a little bit back up again now that oil prices are cheap and gasoline is coming down, all with a nice punch in the face to the mullahs in Iran. We'll get to that later. So now it's the Democrats' turn. And so far, I've been right, and a lot of you folks have been right, too, saying, yeah, they were just 10 years behind because of their fossils that they had in government, just the way the Republicans had their fossils, but now they're slowly being replaced. Well, now the fossilitis of the Democratic Party is being replaced. You know, Nancy Pelosi is out. God rest her soul. Dianne Feinstein, there's no reason she should have been there. Poor woman didn't know what day it was, which way was up. when she was tailing off her numbers. Joe Biden is now resting with, we hope, is better physical news. So what do you have now left in the Democratic Party? A bunch of Jew haters. That's what the party is now. You can say all you want about Donald Trump. You can hate him. You can love him. You can put him up on the wall there with Pope Leo, Frank Sinatra, and Jesus Christ, or Jesus H. Christ, if you'd like. Don't forget the middle name there. But now, what's the Democratic Party made of now? They're all the new ones coming on the scene, because here comes what happened to the Republicans 10 years ago. So you're seeing seeds of it now in Connecticut. Now, thankfully, some of the DSA people in Connecticut are not as left as some of the ones you're seeing, including Mr. Mamdani, the mayor of New York City. We'll get to that in a moment. That's our question of the day. But, man, if you're a Democrat here, how are you not scared, you know, whatless about what's going on with your party? How do you not fear this? How does a guy like Graham Platner start to sniff the Democratic nomination in Maine when everybody is there looking at the fact that he had a Nazi tattoo and you people were getting on Pete Hegseth's tattoo because it was a Christian thing? But, no, Maud, don't say anything about Platner. Why? Because he's going to take out that evil Susan Collins. Yeah, she's horrible. Oh, yeah. She's death on wheels, Susan Collins. So you go and now allegations that he sexually assaulted a woman there. That's shocking, huh? So, you know, I don't mean to laugh that it's humorous, but it kind of is. Not the charges against Graham Platner. That's not what I'm saying here. But what did I say over the past 2 or 3 years? I said, when it starts on the Democratic side, even here in Connecticut, you're seeing it start. Now, granted, Josh Elliott is no Graham Platner. I don't even think he's a Zoran Mamdani either. But, man, if you are a Democrat, are you? Now, listen, Governor Lamont, with all due respect to Josh Elliott and our friend here at the radio station, Brian Fazio, he's likely to win, but stranger things have happened. But how are you people that vote Democrat? How are you not scared of this? And on their point, it's working. Did you see the percentage of Americans now who now have a negative view of Israel? Are one long time. Now, we have other allies in the Middle East. But which is the nation in the Middle East that has stood by America since its founding in 1948? It's the state of Israel. Where in the world, in the Middle East, can a gay person be freely gay or a transsexual person be freely transsexual? A woman can freely wear a bikini on a beach. Israelites, Jews, Palestinians, Arabs, they can all work together in one in one environment there. Leaders of some of the Arab states send their loved ones to Jewish hospitals. So listen, I'm not saying that Israel is beyond repute, that you cannot criticize them, but this is your modern-day Democratic Party. There's another story I just came across before listening to the end of Elisa's show, an outstanding interchange she had with that gentleman earlier, because she knew exactly where he was going. Now the DSA is targeting Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries. Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer are not progressive enough. Oh, my God. Can you say President Vance in 2028? So you Democrats, I want to hear from you. And I ask this question. Maybe it's a matter of when. Could a socialist candidate like Mayor Mamdani in New York be elected to a statewide office or even to Congress from Connecticut? Don't laugh. I know there are people. In fact, and he'll be on with me tomorrow. Gentleman who wrote this story. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought this was a Dan Harr story. Dan, I apologize if you're listening. But I've been told on this program by a lot of people, both on the left and right, oh, no, it's never, you can't have it here in Connecticut. Oh, really? Oh, really? So you Dems tell me the phone lines are open, the text screen is open, the email is open. Is it time to sweat? Is it uh-oh time? Is it ruh-roh Scooby time? Here in Connecticut, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Very simple, very straightforward question. Bunch of people, a couple of dozen people already chiming in here on Facebook. Could a socialist candidate like New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani be elected to a statewide office or to Congress from Connecticut? You tell me, right here on WICC. So I ask the question here, amid some interesting silence here from one of our, or I guess both our U.S. Senate members, I don't know, I'm looking around to see what Mr. Blumenthal may think regarding, and Mr. Murphy may think regarding the, now I guess you can officially call Graham Plattner the embattled Democratic Senate candidate from Maine, because this is what the left likes to call a teachable moment, isn't it? Well, you may be saying, hey, Paul, what's up with, you know, why do you care about this guy from Maine? Because it's a reflection of the party. Just the way people say, well, you can't get away from Trump. Don't tell me you didn't vote for him. No, 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 Kemosabe. Let's not do that, Gunga Din. No, he reflects your party. Okay, yeah, as a registered Republican, I say, yeah, the guy is who he is, and we'll see what happens, you know, after the turn of the year, whether he walks away, which I think he will, but that's just me, or he leaves at the end of his second full term. You know, 12 and a half, 13 years after he came down the Golden Staircase, and we all thought it was a joke. Well, it wasn't. Guess what, in case you're just wondering. But I asked the question, and phone lines are open, text lines. I'm already getting texts here. I'm already getting a bunch of emails. I'm already getting a bunch of responses to our Facebook question of the day. Could a socialist candidate like Zohran Mamdani in New York be elected to a statewide office or to Congress from Connecticut? Now, Governor Ned Lamont, every time he's confronted with that, says, well, we're nowhere near the size of New York City. It's 2.5 times the entire state of Connecticut. And yeah, I kind of get him on that. But there's a bigger picture here, isn't there? Or what am I missing here? What I did miss is what I told you, what was exactly going to happen. It may be slow now, but the main categorization coming up in the November midterms, and more importantly in 2028, do you hate Jews enough or do you hate Israel enough to be a Democrat? I'm sorry if you don't like that. But now when I'm seeing stories today about next in the crosshairs, excuse the expression, that's figure of speech, not talking about gun violence here, but in the political crosshairs, are people like Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer? What is going on with the Democratic Party? And I think it's going to happen sooner than later here in Connecticut. There are a handful of DSA candidates here in the state. Miriam Kahn is one, the state legislator. I think she may be the only. I think there's her and somebody else. The gentleman from Waterford who got in trouble, I think, for running his yap on social media a few months ago. I forgot his name. I'll pick it up for you. But there's two or three of them out there. Now, are they as radical as some of these people? No, maybe not. But I got to tell you something. You Democrats in Connecticut, you may say that I'm a dreamer. No, you may say that you have nothing to worry about. Maybe you don't here in Connecticut, but how are you not worried about your party? Seriously. And the guy that's the titular leader, I've always liked that word, the guy who is the titular leader of the Democratic Party right now is not Chuck Schumer. It's not Hakeem Jeffries. It's not even AOC. It's Zohran Mamdani. Now, kudos to him. He got elected. He ran a fabulous campaign, just the way two out of the three times, and you could say maybe three times, because all those funny votes suddenly disappeared after 2020. I know, I'm just kidding. That's the argument. You could say that politically, Mr. Mamdani and Mr. Trump are, you know, brothers in arms here, like kindred spirits. You could you not? What is up with the Democratic Party? Can somebody please explain to me? What is it? Is it just Israel? Is it? And I know Bernie with the billionaires and the billionaires. Oh, Bernie, can I talk to you? Got to get on my private jet. Bernie, can you fly coach? Are you kidding me? Me? Do you know who I am?
I'm Bernie Sanders. I don't fly coach.
All right, Bernie. Sorry. Traffic and weather.
What? Traffic and weather together on WICC.
All right. A lot of people love Donald Trump. They will do almost anything he says with their money. A lot of people hate him. A lot of people are in the middle. A lot of people yawn. A lot of people can't wait till he's gone. Or some people want him to serve forever. But another Trump-branded thing is out there. So-called Trump accounts. And the beginning of the July month, the new month bringing with them, the Trump accounts. And what are these things? And is this just another vanity project here? Or is this something you may want to know about? We welcome back Gerson Gibbs, senior managing partner of Bellet Capital. He's a former financial industry regulator and examiner who oversaw the financial institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and UBS. Hey, Gerson, good to have you back on. It's Paul in Connecticut. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Explain these Trump accounts. Now, I'm sure there's another alternate way to refer to those, but Gerson, what are these things here? Is this just a vanity project here, or are there advantages to these accounts or not? What do you see from your point of view?
I think there are extreme advantages. It's basically a starter IRA for kids locked until they're 18. And then it converts to a traditional IRA. This is for U.S. citizen babies born between January 1st, 2025 and December 31st, 2028. And they basically get $1,000 of seed money to start their investment career as soon as they're born.
So where does that seed money come from, Gerson? Is this from the Federal Reserve? Is this government money? They just hand you a grant here but say you can't touch it?
It's definitely government-backed. It's government money. There are different companies that are associated with it, but it's coming directly from the government. And they do tell you there's $1,000 of seed money and you're not allowed to touch it, but you are able to invest additional capital into it up to a maximum of $5,000 a year. For smaller individuals, you're able to invest $2,500 a year. So there are some advantages, and it is government-backed.
So what may be, Gerson, and the guest is Gerson Gibbs, a financial and Wall Street veteran here, what are the advantages, Gerson, that this may have versus other starter accounts? Are there one or two things here? Is essentially the free money the big advantage here or not?
Well, the free money is definitely something that you can take advantage of. And there are some caveats. It's not like traditional IRAs where you can remove some of the money with penalties. The money is locked in there. And there's also some restrictions on what you can actually invest in. This administration gives the ability for individuals who qualify for this particular IRA to only be able to invest in low-cost index funds. So you can't invest in every traditional type of instrument. You're only able to invest in certain type of instruments. And I think that's because the government wants to ensure that they're not investing in things that can possibly lose value. He's trying to do safe investments, and it's a way to encourage individuals to invest more.
So basically, Gerson, it's like the old investment strategy, invest in safe things like, you know, companies that make tomato soup, companies that make like napkins, and maybe forego the high tech stuff. Invest in something that's safe and people are going to use.
Exactly. He wants the fees to be capped at about 1%, like S&P 500 companies, simple and deliberate companies, individual stocks and bonds, so on and so forth. He doesn't want you to invest in these speculative investments, because those could potentially lead to losing that money.
So who, Gerson Gibbs, is actually administering this? Can a person go down to their local bank and they go to their local broker, say mom and dad have a portfolio, and they say, hey, you know, maybe they'll call it colloquially, do you handle the Trump accounts? Who actually does a person have to go to, or a family, or a couple, or a mom or a dad to do this?
Well, you have to go to TrumpAccounts.treasury.gov, and you have to apply. You have to go in and actually apply. And there's been a lot of people applying, and interesting statistic is that 86% of them are households that fall below the $200,000 income a year, right? So there's a lot of individuals that I believe aren't traditionally investing or do not come from a lineage or a family that is versed in investing that are taking advantage of this. And that's, I think, great for the community. I think great for the economy, because we're just getting more people involved in the financial industry, which ultimately would lead to more money in the economy.
So that, Gerson, can we have that email address? I'm sorry, that website address again?
It's trumpaccounts.treasury.gov.
All right, trumpaccounts.treasury.gov. So strip away the politics here, Gerson. There's nothing that you see here that's going to ring a lot of alarm bells or set a lot of sirens going crazy.
Well, I think that a lot of things that is branded with the Trump brand may cause a little bit of scrutiny. It may lean towards, you know, he's taking advantage of his position and just trying to further brand himself. That's some slack that could come back from it. Also indicating that they're using government money, misusing government money. But again, I think there's positives and there's negatives, the pros and cons to all of this going on. And I think some of the pros is that individuals that aren't familiar with the investment industry or the financial industry would have the opportunity for their kids to be involved in it very early. I think that the stipulations that are put around it are a little tough because it doesn't give the opportunity to invest in a whole lot of things. But I think from an educational standpoint, mm-hmm. it's a positive thing in my opinion.
All right. Gerson Gibbs back on the program, senior managing partner at Bellet Capital, a former financial industry regulator and examiner who at the time oversaw big institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and UBS. Gerson, good to talk with you, my friend, and we'll chat down the road. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Gerson Gibbs there, senior managing partner, Bellet Capital, Bellet, B-E-L-I-T-E, Capital, former financial industry regulator at the time. He oversaw big institutions or helped oversee big institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and UBS. Hey, listen, you love Trump, you hate him, you want to invest in this. I just wanted to get this out there for people saying, hey, is this going to be like Trump wines, Trump steaks, Trump University? Oh, man. Trumpaccounts.treasury.gov. So there you be. All right. Helping your investment future right here on WICC. Our buddy, our pal, our good friend, Megan Portfolio, she of the Hartford Portfolio there and the Yankee Institute, has been looking into the governor's campaign and what may or may not have been promised a week or so ago. Ms. Portfolio, good afternoon, ma'am, and how might you be?
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
I'm good. Boy, you sound chipper and spry today, man.
Oh, I got floor seats to the Suns tomorrow, so I'm in a good mood.
Really? Yeah. Now, you're a big Canadian, so are you. Yeah, you're kind of bummed. I mean, they're
going
to
Houston. Very bitter, actually.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I'll market it.
Go Fever.
Wow.
I told you I'm bitter.
Yeah, but you know how this works. You're a marketer. You understand ad dollars.
I know.
I know, right. Does it mean you can't make a couple of roadies during the season next year and go to Houston?
Oh, it's possible.
See, there you go.
It's possible.
There you go. Tell Carol and all the folks at the Institute.
Carol, if you're listening.
Listen. It's an assignment. I have to go down there and cover the team. All right, speaking of covering, you're watching the governor's race. And I guess in your latest piece, you're asking something that I'm kind of wondering, too. This latest AFL-CIO thing was behind closed doors, and nobody knows exactly what was said or promised, do they?
No, no one knows, and it's actually kind of weird. So the end of last month, AFL-CIO, which is this huge labor federation, there's about 250,000 members. That's an army. They held their, you know, they do these endorsements, you know, every, you know, 4 years. And back in 2018, it was kind of public. And 2022, it was still public. And then for some reason this year, all behind closed doors. Now, they were saying that members were nervous to speak candidly for fear that their names would be in the press.
Yeah.
So they held it by, which is fine. I get it. And you know what? They're probably, you know, they're an organization. They're allowed to conduct their business the way they see fit. However, when there's tax dollars on the line, that may be cool for the AFL-CIO to have all this behind closed doors. But when you got a candidate who is clearly probably making some promises to the unions, I mean, we kind of have a right to know, because how are we supposed to make informed choices on who we're voting for if we don't know, you know, whose hands are getting greased? Like, for example, back in 2018, the AFL-CIO endorsed Lamont, and they bragged right after the elections that, you know, they sent out thousands and thousands of door knockers.
Yeah.
They had thousands of people making phone calls. They had thousands of people sending out mailers. And Lamont only, I mean, I'm saying only won by 44,000 votes, but that's really not a lot in our state. You know, that's single-digit percentage, you know, difference between Stefanowski and Lamont. And, you know, you don't know. I mean, that could have tipped the scales in Lamont's favor. And the things that he promised them back then were $15 minimum wage. Mm-hmm. He promised them paid family medical leave. And of course, there was all, you know, all the CBAC contracts with the raises. So what's on the line this time? I mean, coincidentally, the CBAC contract is up next year in 2027, and that's where they're going to be renegotiating pensions and health care. And we have trolls on the Yankee Institute social media, and they're state workers, and they're bold. They want better pensions. They want caps on their health care, and they'll put this right in the comments on our social media. Some of them, they even do it during work hours, which is super annoying.
The other thing Megan Portfolio is, and of course, Megan of the Hartford Portfolio on the Yankee Institute's website, the other thing is they made no bones about it. In some of the quotes I did see, in some of the coverage I did see, was that they are still seething that the governor vetoed the paid strikers bill last time.
Oh, my God,
around.
They're still shedding tears over that. It's like, enough already. Three strikes, you're out. Like, let's move on.
I'm wondering, Megan, you said, like, what was said behind closed doors? Did the governor say, hey, stick with me on this? I'm trying to get changes to it. You know, maybe what would the original bill say? Because you probably read it. You start to get paid 2 weeks in. Maybe he says, I'll get him to do 4 or 5 weeks, right? I mean, it could have been that, too. Maybe.
Well, I obviously, I don't know, because I wasn't in the meeting. I find it, I would be very disappointed if Lamont went that route, because, I mean, he's been consistent on this issue. He's been very honest about the issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe he was just honest with the unions. And maybe he's like, guys, ain't happening. Like, it's just not happening. We need to move on. We've got these CBAC contracts that are, you know, that's coming up. And you know, AFL-CIO, they're a big government employee union. So, I mean, maybe that is something that they were more, you know, thinking about, because they've actually, back in 2024, they were already screaming about the contract and how they want more robust benefits. That was my favorite. I'm like, how much more robust can you get?
Yeah.
Healthcare for life, pension for life.
And maybe, you know, Megan, maybe they see that, and maybe this was discussed with the governor, too. Maybe they see, hey, we have these benefits now that are decent or good or very good, and we're paying down the long-term debt. The governor boasts about that, which, again, is only because of the Republican guardrails. And maybe the unions are saying, hey, you're paying down all this debt. We're saving money, supposedly, by somebody's math, on the interest here on these payments. So, you know, loosen up a little, Gov. You know, maybe that's what they're saying. I don't know. None of us were there. We don't know.
Or maybe telework. I mean, Gavin Newsom out in California is bringing his state employees back to work. So maybe that was on the table. But this just goes back to my original thesis that, you know, we kind of need to know these things. So how can anyone make an informed decision on who they want to be governor if we don't really know what you're going to be doing when you get into office?
You know what you should do next time around, so the next election will be in 2030, I'm sure we'll all be here, God willing, you should disguise yourself as a union worker. Just
oh goodness, just, you get me fired. And arrested. I don't know what's worse.
Megan Smith, local, just make up a union. You know, on your badge, the
I'm the Connecticut State Thick Tank Union.
On the Amalgamated Local 123, the Amalgamated Candy Tasters. Well, you can, and you know, you have to wear like a fake mustache and fake sideburns and everything. Just kidding. Come on, you'd love it, wouldn't you?
Oh, I think you just picked out my next Halloween costume.
You like that, huh? You like that. All right, folks, check it out. Megan Portfolio, go to yankeeinstitute.org and find the click-on spot for the Hartford Portfolio. As always, Megan, great stuff. We appreciate it. Take care. Be safe, and don't speed in your town because they're putting up more speed cameras. So we.
Oh, I know. I'm very excited. Yeah, there's a future article coming about me. So I'm starting to get annoyed.
No, you know what? If you could, because Megan and I have so many people who called, because, you know, here in Fairfield County, Fairfield, Milford, they're coming to all these times. And even though you, I'm sure you read the bill when it was up, how many pages and all the regulatory things here, people just still are very leery of it. So I'm sure you'll do a good job on that. I am sure.
Yeah, I'm starting to get super. At first, I didn't mind so much because I have so much on my plate, but now I'm getting annoyed, will equal me writing an article.
Excellent. All right, Meg, thanks. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All right, there you go. And if you are thinking maybe later on today, tonight, tomorrow, anytime in the foreseeable future, as thousands do from the area, hopping on a Metro North and heading into the Big Apple, oh man, is there ruh-roh, Scooby, there is a problem in Midtown. A building under construction remains unstable after it was evacuated earlier today. Workers reported cracking inside the structure and support beams buckling. Mayor Zohran Mamdani, FDNY, they all got there at about 8 a.m. Active construction site, East 42nd between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. So right in the heart of Midtown there, bordering the theater district. 37-story building. It's the old Pfizer building. It's being converted from commercial space to residential apartments. Oh, man, they're adding some floors on top of 22 existing floors there. Good God. Joining us right now, gentlemen we've had on the program several times, Associate Professor of Civil Engineering, Professor Ari Perez from our friends at Quinnipiac University. Hey, Ari, it's Paul. Good afternoon, man. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me again, Paul. I'm excited to talk to you about this.
Yeah, good. Yeah, let's go, Ari. at what level is the FDNY, NYPD, and Mayor Mamdani, are they just sitting there going, holy crap? Give us a shakedown on this, Ari. What's involved here? This is an old building being renovated, right?
Yes, sir. So as you mentioned, they are adding some existing building, which is, of course, adding a load to the building.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have any information besides the public, and I'm guessing that's probably where the problem originated. And so they saw some deformation of structural members, which is, A, certainly worrying, but B, one of the things that I really want to get through is that these buildings, when they are designed, we do think about failure, and this is what's supposed to happen. That is to say, it's not supposed to happen in the sense that everything is okay, but the visible deformation doesn't mean immediate collapse. It means, hey, things are going wrong. We should probably stop and take a look at it. So I think the response, which has been, let's get everybody out to safety, and let's just figure out what's happening, is exactly what you want folks to do.
Yeah, Ari, I'm going to have you move around a little bit if you can. You're breaking up just a little, so if you could relocate a little bit for me, I'd appreciate it. So, when a building like this, Ari, is constructed, and of course this is the old Pfizer headquarters, how is the decision made from a civil engineering point of view, which is your expertise, to say, okay, we can add not one or two floors here. We can add all these floors. I mean, how do you test out a structure here, Ari, in this situation to know that it's physically safe? I mean, I know running the numbers is one thing, but do you use AI here? How do you do this?
So as far as I know, nobody uses AI for this. This is still a person-driven process. You do a variety of things, you know. You look at the old plans, the as-built plans that were produced at the end of construction, to figure out what's in there. And like you say, you run a theoretical analysis.
Yeah.
You also run non-destructive testing, or sometimes even destructive testing, where you take a sample and you figure out what is the condition of this. Like, is this as strong as it was meant to be? You do visual inspection to make sure that everything looks okay. So the determination of how much load to add is a multi-pronged process that doesn't just depend on one source of data. It depends on simulations and software and a lot of people making a rational decision. When you build something, you know, you often don't use the material to its fullest strength.
Yeah.
And so it is quite common that buildings can take a higher load than they are currently doing. But, you know, sometimes there are errors in the process going back to construction or even design that can happen.
Associate Professor of Civil Engineering, Professor Ari Perez, joining us right now to talk about this building in Midtown Manhattan that they heard some cracking today. And Ari, I guess, I don't know whether you heard on our newscast, the top and bottom of the hour, they are detecting some movement, too. So, you know, put yourself, if you can, Ari, in the engineers that are probably sitting there looking at this, looking over old plans. Look, Ari, I'm no civil engineer like you are. I'm guessing movement is not good. But you tell me, am I wrong here? What are we looking at here?
No, you are completely correct. The old joke is that a mechanical engineer designs things that move and a civil designs things that don't.
Yeah,
you know, I do want to say it depends on the magnitude and kind of type of movement. I am a soils engineer. I do geotechnical, and buildings will sink naturally. That's part of the process. Mm-hmm. Every building or every material, when you subject a load to it, there is a deformation that can happen. Is just, can you notice it or not? Certainly movement that is unexpected, like it is right now, where nothing is really happening and the movement is still being detected, that's really worrisome. And that's part of the reason why you had to evacuate everybody. Like, the possibility of collapse is so dire that you really have to play it safe. The movement by itself doesn't mean anything more than things are happening. It may lead to a collapse or it may not, but it's certainly not something you want to see for sure.
Yeah, finally, Ari, that was going to be my next question. I mean, at what point does an engineer, a structural engineer, a civil engineer like yourself, at what point do you folks look at each other and say, no, we can't do this? And then, making that decision, I guess, is one thing, Ari. Then, if you have to disassemble this building in the middle of Midtown, I mean, oh my God, is there a process for that? How do they even do that?
Yeah, those are both great questions. You know, when do you call it? That is a tough question. Certainly calling people to evacuate and for the zone to be frozen around, that's an easy call because, you know, you want to make sure that everybody's safe. So you get everybody out first thing. But it is not without cost to keep this area closed. You know, economic cost, kind of like people need to move around and stuff. And it is going to be a tough decision to do. I think they're going to keep monitoring the data. One of the things that happened is, once materials start failing, they will continue to fail without any additional load. Think of like the paperclip. You have to bend it pretty far at first to get it to break, but at some point you kind of just look at it sideways and it crumbles.
Yeah.
And so they will monitor, is the building stabilizing, which means, okay, as long as we don't touch it, it won't move again. Or is it still moving, which means, oh, things are still breaking, they're moving, they're juggling about. I think any continued movement will likely mean they're not going to stop this.
Wow.
Afterwards, when do you call it? If there is collapse, you kind of wait for it to happen, you know, make sure everybody's safe, give it as much space, and do that. If the building stabilizes without collapse, but they do want to take it down, you know, demolition experts, which I am not one by any means, but they have these incredible techniques and pretty safe processes, so I think demolition will be logistically complicated, but safe.
Yeah, and finally, Ari, are projects like this, from a civil engineering point of view and yours, are these projects insured? I mean, is this, if they have to call a stop on this and take it down, are the investors here? Is the city, the construction company, who's ever behind this renovation, are they insured for this, or are they just going to lose all this money?
Well, you know, there are so many litigations that depend on things like this, and the answer is, it just depends what the cause is. You know, a lot of contracts will have, like, provisions for like acts of God, which this wasn't it, right? But like if the designers had bad information, that kind of insulates them. And so if there is a kind of like process to find liability and who has to pay for this and whatever, I think it's going to be a long process before everybody sorts it out. You know, people come to like experts to like give their testimony and their expert opinion. And this can be a pretty long and expensive process. So I am sure there will be some insurance on it, but whether it goes under the payout or, you know, anybody that's had to deal with insurance knows that just because you make a claim doesn't mean that it gets adjudicated to you. That might happen.
Yeah. Our friends in the legal profession, they'll be happy, right? A lot of billable hours there. Ari Perez, Associate Professor, Civil Engineering, Quinnipiac University. Ari, thank you, man. Good to chat with you. We'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Paul. Have a wonderful day.
All right, Ari, thank you. Ari Perez there, Associate Professor, Civil Engineering, Quinnipiac University. Man, you look at this situation, all you could say is yikes.